Are we back again, tape two? Okay, thank you, everyone. We're back in open meeting, if you will. The public has been invited back into the commission room. Let the minutes will show the executive session was adjourned at 2:20, 10 minutes later than initially anticipated, but that's okay. The public, like I said, has been invited back into the room. We're now in open session. I don't believe we have any motions to handle, but for general discussion, I wanted to do a couple of things in the open session. Is the roving grain buyers, the bond levels, can you have federal roving grain buyer bonds? Just state, right?
Only state.
Okay. And so how much discussion have we had on the state bond level for roving grain buyers?
Probably not nearly as much as we have on the grain warehousemen. And this bond level has been in place for ever since we changed it in the 90s after.
Well, where I'm going with this is that I know that a lot of times with, not a lot of times, but when there's ability to get a federal bond, we've had a lot of discussion with grower groups in the past, and there wasn't a lot of desire to change the bond level because you could raise the state bond level to a certain point, and then all you do is you push them over to a federal bond. But for roving grain buyers, it seems like, in my mind, they have nowhere to go but the state bond. So maybe we should look at the level of bonds for roving grain buyers because it's a state's, I don't know, state's choice to do this or not.
Are they in rules?
At the time, yes, they are in rules. And at the time that the schedule was established, it was based on what an anticipated purchase would be, like comparable to doing business if you were a grain elevator. It's like the minimum bond for a grain elevator is $50,000. So that's where we started. And then we used, I think it's the moves in increments of 20. I'm trying to think how that works up to a certain point and then less. So I think it's at the same basis as a grain warehouse. Like for 100,000 bushels, it would move by 20 cents.
Would you say
cents.
That most of our insolvencies, more insolvencies than not, have to deal with roving grain buyer's license?
No, this is our second roving grain buyer insolvency since I've been at the commission in 30 years.
Okay. All right.
Did we pay out the full? I'm curious, what was the other one? I don't remember.
No, the other one was Spence Grain in the 90s, and they only received a small share. He went into bankruptcy, and I don't know.
How many roving grain buyer's licenses are out there?
Oh, 70-some.
Okay. And then let's see here, bond levels. I don't know if that's something that Randy and Julie want to talk about is roving grain buyer's bonds. The whole bonding issue is one that's out there that I'm not very comfortable with some of the raising our state bonds and there's a federal bond in play. But roving bonds, it just seems like if the law is such that it has played out these last cases, we're more vulnerable for our producers with roving grain buyers than we are in traditional. So maybe that's something we should look at.
And the higher price of grain, of course, has affected that. They did actually, based on what their handle and based on what our schedule is, they did have the required bond amount on file.
Oh, maybe we should raise the required amount, though.
Right.
But we get monthly reports from them?
Yes, we do.
Or something on how much they're handling?
Yes. I just wanted to point out that they weren't under bond based on our schedule.
Right, absolutely.
Yeah. But they do. They file a monthly report showing us what their purchases are, and then they file a culmination on their renewal, and we compare what their monthly purchases were with the figure that they give us on their renewal, and that is, if it's not within just a slight amount of bushels, then we contact them.
Well, I never suggest that we're doing anything wrong in the state. We just find ourselves in these
right.
multi-state insolvencies
yeah, right.
that our law, North Dakota law, we end up, nice for North Dakota, the laws, we end up being the last person there. And so it becomes the fallback is just our bond.
Yeah.
And so if we're truly going to protect the producers, we've got to find that right soft spot about the bond levels. And we really haven't moved that for a long time.
And if you stop and think about it, if the idea behind having a grain warehouse bond is that you're going to have inventory on hand that gets used in addition to having the bond, then our roving grain buyer bonds, when there's no inventory on hand, is way lesser than what it.
Right. We don't want to overreact if there's only been two, because I thought there was more than two.
This is our second one.
Okay. I didn't have anything else, Julie.
I have nothing else.
I have nothing else except to say that this is just, you know, one of a number of things that, you know, in these not quite 4 months has really alarmed me. Being one, I never realized how vulnerable farmers are in all these transactions, or in just about all of them. The banks have so much better position than the farmers. We're dealing with these people who are hauling the stuff out of state, and then we're subject to other people's laws. Mm-hmm. And bond levels that are too low and can't really be raised because of, as you say, we don't want to see it shift away or cause more people to just do business like Mitchell did originally without any bond. It is truly a dangerous, almost a roll of the dice when people are selling their products anymore.
Well, but the groups, the Farm Bureau, the Farmers Union, the corn growers, the grain growers, when we go talk to them, their leadership is aware of the vulnerability, but they don't push it down to the membership. And so anything we can do to facilitate this discussion, I think, is part of what we should be doing. But it's the leaderships of these organizations get it, but they don't push it down. So we just...
On that same notion, it's made me also question the sensibility of a policy that pretends to protect people and makes them feel like they're being protected when really there's a lot of limitations how much they're being protected. You almost wonder if it would be better if they just realized they weren't protected and didn't think that they were, and then they would take it upon themselves to understand these transactions better and how they're where they're vulnerable and where they're not and how they can get their money, be assured their money. Because, yeah, we're kind of in that middle ground right now where people think they're protected. They're not protected as much as they are. And if they knew that, they'd probably spend more time thinking about and researching some of these companies that they're doing business with, selling, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of product.
Sure, and to put a finer point, and different commissioners have sat here at different times I've sat with and said, listen, this is a social program that is out there that protects people, that everybody pays for, and if you do a good job of knowing who you're buying and selling from, that's where you end up at. This is not a state responsibility to protect all these farmers. So that's a philosophical discussion that we've had the full gamut here. And I'm sure it's been more since you guys have been here, but that becomes the rub right there. Because right now, you're right, we're not protecting to the level they think they are. And I think that's because, is that a role? I mean, because how much would you have to raise a bond to do it? You'd have to have bonds at $500,000.
That's right. $500,000 would give you 50 cents.
Yep. So then how much would each person pay in each bushel at that big a bond? It'd be a very large amount.
Well, I'm not sure any roving grain buyer would ever even get licensed. And would that be good or would that be worse?
Yeah.
I mean, would you take a bigger chance on operating illegally if you were required to file a $500,000 bond?
Yeah.
You know, in almost any industry, you can sit and make arguments for it that the government is involved in helping that industry
tax break
stay alive. We also are oftentimes involved in making it more miserable for them, too. But, you know, whether it's utility companies who we provide a right to eminent domain for, or you just go down almost anything you want, you can find something where the government is involved, at least for the perception of making things better. Years ago, I presume, people came through and were ripping off farmers, and that's why these kinds of licensing and bonding requirements were put in place. And they've been relatively untouched for a century, and they're outdated, and they don't provide adequate protection anymore. And so I think, there's a big question. Do we just quit letting people believe there's protection when there's not? Or is there a way to update the protections to the modern world of agriculture? And I don't know the answer to that, but I sure intend to keep working on it.
Well, that's why we have these strategic planning
meetings. Good effort.
Okay. Going once, going twice, Julie.
Okay.
Randy? Good. All right, with that, we'll close the special meeting. Thank you.